learned there were people out there that could work on the properties he bought and get them in better shape, improving their value and putting equity into Mike's new business. For single-family homes in bad physical condition, Mike would need a contractor. For multifamily homes with bad tenants or low rents, Mike would need a good property manager with a plan to improve the NOI, net operating income. For properties with old, undesirable floor plans, Mike would need to find someone to help him move walls and create new space. For properties missing bedrooms or bathrooms, Mike would need to find people to help him get permits and add the space the properties would need to bring them to their top value. None of this scared Mike, as he knew he had done it before, and many other investors were doing the same thing. Mike knew he was onto something and decided to write down his business plan. Just like buying distressed debt, Mike knew he wouldn't be able to obtain financing to buy those assets that were in the worst shape. The whole reason he was getting them for pennies on the dollar is because they weren't worth anything to a lender. Mike looked at his financial situation and made a decision. He knew it might cause him to start off slower, but he decided he would save up enough money to be able to buy distressed property for cash. Once it was purchased, he would use his cash to get the property in better condition, improving its value. Once the property was improved, Mike would finance it, recover as much of his initial capital as possible, and repeat the process. Mike knew this model would work because it was already something he was doing in his distressed debt business. Once he had his plan in place, Mike got busy saving money. He also told his friends and family what his plan was so they could keep him accountable. At the end of year one, Mike had $42,000 saved up, just as planned. This wasn't enough to buy anything, and Mike faced ridicule from those he had shared his plan with. Many people told him it had been an entire year and he had done nothing, and mocked him for talking such a big talk. But Mike continued on. At the end of year two, he now had $84,000 saved up. Quite an accomplishment. Mike faced even more ridicule, as it had now been two whole years and still nothing. At the end of year two, Wise William gave Mike a call to ask how things had been going. Mike told William he had $84,000 saved up and was eager to get started. William told Mike to start getting the word out to agents, wholesalers, and bird dogs that he was looking for a property he could pay cash for in the $50,000 to $60,000 range. Mike did just that. About 2 months into year three, Mike found his first deal. An agent called him saying one of their investors had started a project and ran out of money, and the investor needed to sell, quick. The investor was racking up debt to their hard money lender, and the property was in danger of being foreclosed on. Mike asked the agent for the numbers. The rent was $100 lower than Tom was getting, and the ARV was also $5,000 less. Mike purchased the property, conducted the rehab, and rented the property to a tenant. Mike found a portfolio lender that would allow him to refinance after owning the property for 4 months. 4 months after purchasing, he refinanced the property with a bank that let him borrow 75% of the appraised value, the ARV. Just like Tom, Mike proceeded with this plan for the next 15 years. Unlike Tom, Mike's plan produced a compound effect that changed the entire landscape of his real estate investing. Because Mike was using the Burr method, his portfolio grew at a much different rate from Tom's. Tom's portfolio grew in a linear fashion. Each year, Tom purchased one house. He saved the same amount of capital. He purchased the same priced house. And he made the same cash flow. Tom's portfolio grew in a linear and predictable fashion. Mike's portfolio grew much differently because Mike was able to use his capital much more efficiently. After refinancing his first house, Mike immediately bought another and repeated the process. After he refinanced that, Mike bought a third house. because he could refinance every 4 months, Mike was able to buy 3 houses a year with the same capital he saved in year one. Remember, while Mike was purchasing 3 homes in year two, he was also still working and saving money. This allowed him to have more capital to invest in real estate each year than the year before. As Mike was able to save $42,000 a year, he could purchase 1 additional house every 2 years than he could before, assuming he is buying houses at an average all-in price of $84,000. This exponential growth means that by the end of year 15, Mike will have purchased a total of 84 homes. Now, before going any further, I want to make a few quick points. No, I don't expect everyone to want to own 84 homes. I understand that may not be practical. I'm just illustrating a point here. And yes, those numbers are accurate. Pairing the Burr method with finding an area to invest in that has the right price points, inventory, and rents that work for you would allow you to also replicate Mike's numbers. Also, I gave Tom 16 years, whereas I only gave Mike 15. Mike's numbers would have ended up even more impressive given that last year, but I wanted to give Tom an advantage to help drive my point home. Let's dig a little deeper into Mike's portfolio after 15 years of hard work and Burr magic. Assuming Mike's rent increased at the same rate as Tom's, 3% annually, Mike's average rent per property would have gone from $1,000 to $1,480. This meant Mike's cash flow would have increased from $383 a month to $854 a month. With 84 units bringing in $854 in gross cash flow, Mike would be looking at $71,736 in gross cash flow a month. This does not include all the cash flow he made during the 15 years he was building the portfolio. If we had included that cash flow, Mike would have ended up with even more than 84 houses at the end because he would have had more capital with which to buy them. Assuming that not even one of Mike's properties appreciated over that 15-year time span, Mike would have accumulated an average of $21,000 a property, $84,000 all-in price, plus $5,000 closing costs equals $89,000. ARV of $110,000 minus $89,000 equals $21,000 in equity. As you can tell, these are conservative numbers for both Tom and Mike. The real estate market goes through ups and downs, but it's always trended upward due to inflationary pressures. Tom and Mike would also have more than likely received raises during these times and would probably have found ways to get better and better deals the longer they invested. We always get better at things through repetition. It stands to reason Mike would have done much, much better than he did in this hypothetical story. But even if with conservative assumptions, he did very well. Let's compare Tom's final numbers with Mike's. Tom's final numbers. Number of properties, 15. Gross cash flow, $14,775. Total equity in properties, $0. Mike's final numbers. Number of properties, 84. Gross cash flow, $71,736. Total equity in properties, $1,764,000. An analysis of the results. First off, it is obvious Mike's strategy outperformed Tom's. I tried very hard to keep all the variables as consistent as I could between the two investors, and it was very apparent which strategy was superior. While I'm sure many of you assumed the Burr strategy would prove to be the better model, I wanted to point out just how much better the strategy is. Let's break down some of the differences between the two strategies and highlight why Mike's produced such a radically better result than Tom's. I won't go over everything, but some of the big differences should be pointed out. That way, as you continue reading the book, you'll develop a better understanding for why Burr is better. Mike's ROI was noticeably better than Tom's. Tom's average ROI was about 14%. Mike's was about 71%. This difference led to Mike's massively larger gross cash flow. Tom was focused on building more cash flow, while Mike was focused on making his money work harder for him. This led to a very different final outcome for the two investors. Mike was able to achieve such a larger ROI because of the way he structured his deals. By refinancing his properties after he improved them, Mike left much less money in each deal. This helped him in many ways, one of them being an increased ROI. Lesson: ROI matters. We should all expect our money to work hard for us, just as we would if we had employees. The traditional method allows your money to be lazy. The Burr method forces it to work hard and serve you better. Mike's capital was used repeatedly. Tom's was used once. Mike was able to save money and invest it. His investments brought him equity and cash flow, which is what he wanted. Tom was able to do the same, absent the equity part. What Mike did differently is what made the major impact. After gaining his equity and cash flow, Mike pulled money back out of the house to use again, while Tom left his money in the property to stay there. Mike sacrificed cash flow in doing this. His loans were larger than Tom's, and therefore his mortgage was higher. This led to lower cash flow in each deal. In spite of this, Mike made more cash flow in the end. Why? Because Mike used his capital over and over to continue buying deals that would give him equity and cash flow. He forced his money to work harder. Mike found a good thing and repeated it many times. Tom found a good thing and got one shot at it. Mike made his money work harder for him by recycling the same money. Tom used his money once. Tom looked at money like a financial gift he gave to someone in need, a one-time investment. Mike looked at money more like how a business owner looks at employees. Mike's money was like a construction crew he hired and trained for his construction business. He sent them on a job, and when they had earned him a profit, he sent them on to the next job. He kept them working, and with each job they got better, faster, and more skilled. Mike's crew would get better and better with each job they did, making him more and more money in the process. Lesson: Tom didn't make his money work or teach it to perform better. We should always have high expectations for our money. Money is hard to make and hard to keep. The velocity of our money makes a very big difference in the overall wealth-building game. We should always be looking for ways to improve it, and we should have high expectations for how to make it work. Mike avoided light rehabs and bought better deals. Tom focused on light rehabs because he wanted to use less money for improvements and more for down payments. He was correct in understanding he'd be better off using the money to purchase more assets, but he was incorrect in the way he went about doing that. By avoiding larger rehabs, Tom inadvertently ended up avoiding better deals. Rental properties on the MLS that don't need much work typically don't see as large of a discount. Why would they? Mike figured this out faster than Tom and was able to take advantage of it to grow his wealth faster. Our first priority should be finding deals we can purchase under market value. This doesn't always include a major rehab, but it often will. Mike looked for deals and solutions to the problems that would have prevented him from buying them. Tom looked for an easy purchase. Lesson: every deal we buy should be for as much under market value as possible. Buying properties under market value is a foundational tenet to good investing and should be practiced as much as is practical. You make your money when you buy is one of the oldest and truest real estate maxims around. There is no substitute for buying a good deal. Focus first on how to find great deals, and wealth will end up finding you. Mike added equity to his deals. Mike realized larger rehabs led to better deals, which led to more equity. By adding equity to all his deals, Mike grew his wealth at a much faster rate than Tom did. In addition to this, Mike was able to recover much more of his initial capital when he refinanced than Tom did. This gave him more capital to buy more deals and empowered him to end up with 84 houses, not 15. At the end of 15 years of investing, this led to Mike having $1,764,000 of equity in his portfolio, while Tom had none. If Mike didn't like the thought of owning 84 single-family properties, he could sell them and use the equity to purchase a large multifamily building. Mike's equity gave him options. Lesson: equity grows your wealth, not just cash flow. Mike grew this much equity, and this is without any form of appreciation at all. Not likely after 15 years. Look for ways to add equity to every single deal you buy, and you'll watch your wealth grow quickly. Adding bedrooms, bathrooms, square footage, and other tricks are great ways to do that, which we will talk about later in the book. Mike sought counsel before he started. Tom saw an infomercial and realized he wanted to invest in real estate. He wasn't wrong. Tom's decision made him a lot of money and set him up for a much better retirement. Tom wouldn't have regretted this decision. Mike sought the advice of a wiser, more experienced real estate investor before he got started. He spent an additional year gathering information. It led to the birth of a strategy that ended up making him noticeably more money than Tom. Both Tom and Mike used strategies that made sense to them based on previous decisions they had made in life. Tom was a traditional guy who took a traditional vocational path and followed the traditional investing model. Mike was an entrepreneur who was used to looking for creative solutions to problems and wasn't scared at the thought of doing things a little differently. Where Tom saw risk, Mike saw opportunity. This opportunity led to massive results over time. Lesson: fear is healthy. It can prevent us from making mistakes and sometimes protect us. But as an emotion, we can't just follow it blindly. Like a sign on the beach that says, "Caution, high tides can cause dangerous conditions," we should take note of the warning and look to see if the ocean is at high tide. If it's not, we should enjoy a great day of surfing. If it is, we should wait until the tide goes low. If we can't tell the difference, we should educate ourselves before jumping in. Don't assume when you feel the emotion of fear that it's justified. Dig deeper and explore whether or not you should be obeying it. Oftentimes, our fears are based on past experiences that have nothing to do with the question we are facing now. When you're unsure, surround yourself with facts, wise counsel, and educate yourself. Mike would have lost out on an immense amount of wealth if he didn't take the time and effort to work through his fears first. Mike's volume was noticeably higher. Mike bought way more houses than Tom, 69 more, and in one less year. With one additional year, Mike would have had an additional 10 homes. Even though Mike's cash flow was lower than Tom's, the sheer volume of it produced more income. This is one of the benefits that comes with more volume. Mike was able to produce much more volume with the same amount of capital Tom was using. Mike just used it more efficiently. By repeating this process year in and year out, over a 15-year time span, Mike was able to produce a vastly superior result through vastly superior volume. Lesson: volume amplifies your results, both positive or negative. When you are losing money, volume can cause you to lose a lot more. When you are making money, you can make a lot more. Use volume as a tool when you've found a good thing, but only once you've found a good thing. Move slowly until you know the process you're using is leading to the result you want. Then you can step up your volume. Key points. The Burr model outperforms the traditional model in every relevant statistical category. There are two ways to add value to a property: buy at a low price, buying equity, or add value through the rehab process, build or force equity. Burr increases your ROI by lowering the investment basis left in a deal. Burr builds wealth faster by increasing the velocity of your money. Burr increases efficiency by returning more of your capital to you and maximizing leverage. Mastering each element of Burr will make you an overall better investor in general. Mike's ROI was nearly 71% versus Tom's 14% ROI. Burr made a huge difference in the end result of the two investors' portfolios. Part 2. Buying Great Deals. Chapter 2. Buying Under Market Value. How many millionaires do you know who have become wealthy by investing in savings accounts? I rest my case. Robert G. Allen. As we just learned about in the hypothetical story of Tom and Mike, buying right is important. Buying right is a phrase used in real estate that simply means buying an investment property at a price that makes it a good deal. This is an entire book written to teach you one thing: how to make more money in real estate. Buying right is the single most important thing you can do if you want to accomplish that. Learning to buy right and find great deals is what allows all the rest of Burr to work. Because it's so important, we are going to spend a lot of time going over how to find great deals, how to pay less for them, and how to get the very most out of everything you buy. Excelling at this area of real estate is what will open the doors to put everything else you learn into practice. To simplify this as much as possible, we are going to consider buying right to mean paying as little as possible for a deal, but still being able to get the owners to agree to sell to us. To inexperienced investors, this means lowballing 100 sellers a month and hoping something sticks. To the experienced investor, this means targeting sellers in some form of distress who are more likely to work with a buyer who isn't going to pay top dollar. By narrowing in on those most likely to be attracted to our offer to buy their property, we increase our odds of finding a win-win situation. Three forms of distress. What does this mean? If you want to be a successful real estate investor, you need to get good at targeting people in distress. Now, there are three kinds of distress we target as investors, and we are going to touch on all three at different times in the book. They are: 1. Market distress. 2. Personal distress. 3. Property distress. Market distress is when an entire market, economy, or area is in a rough time. Think of 2010, when the housing crisis was at its peak and there were for sale signs on every 4 to 5 houses in some markets. California, Nevada, Arizona, Florida, lots of different markets were in such distress that savvy investors could throw a rock and hit a deal. This is the easiest time to find deals, but the one you have the least amount of control over. If you rely on market distress, you will spend the majority of your time waiting and not investing. Personal distress is how professional, full-time investors target deals. It's how most wholesalers find deals. Personal distress is when the owner of a property is in some form of distress in their personal life that is affecting their finances. Examples would be a divorce, a lost job, a death in the family, trust sales, sudden medical expenses, etc. Personal distress is the best form of distress to target if you want to find deals with the highest margin. It is also the most difficult. Finding those in personal distress involves a large amount of time, energy, and focus devoted to creating and developing relationships with professionals who are likely to come across people going through tough financial times. Property distress is when the property itself is in such bad condition that its value is affected. Properties that need large amounts of work to be livable are a form of property distress. Examples include leaking roofs, foundational problems, significant pest problems, termite damage, obsolete floor plans, etc. Property distress is the form of distress that involves the most work, but it is also the easiest form to target and the one you have the most control over finding. As a BRRRR investor, this is the type of distress you will typically find yourself targeting the most. Once you learn the three kinds of distress, you can start evaluating which of these three is best suited for your personality, risk tolerance, and skill set. For example, if you're great with people, networking, and building relationships, you'd be best suited to target personal distress. By letting your entire network know you're looking for people in trouble who need a quick sale, you're more likely to find great deals before someone else does. If you're busier, working a full-time job, or have other time commitments, property distress might be a better option for you to target. By having an agent search for properties that need a lot of work, you can focus on making money in other ways while your construction crew or rehab team takes care of the problem, the work the property needed, that allowed you to buy it at a discounted rate. If you know yourself well enough to know that you don't want to learn investing, don't like risk, and just want something easy to dump your money into that won't take much of your time, you may settle for the fact market distress is your best bet. If this is you, saving money consistently and waiting for the next crash may be your best bet. No matter which method you feel is best for you, or if you want to use all three, understand that buying right is where everything starts. Buying properties below market value will open up the rest of the doors we talk about in the book. Rules of thumb. Before we dive right in, there are a few basics we should cover first. Nothing I do in real estate investing is all that brand new or innovative. The majority of it has been done many times before I even thought of it by many different people. These people who have gone before me have recognized patterns in their process that led to success. These patterns have come to be known as rules of thumb and are now practiced by many successful investors all over the country. I'm going to share a few of these rules of thumb that apply most consistently to the BRRRR strategy. Learning them will shorten your own learning curve, as well as help you analyze potential deals much faster, giving you time to spend on more productive activities. The 1% rule. The 1% rule is a very simple maxim that states if a property will rent for 1% of the price you paid for it, it's likely to cash flow positively. This is a very important metric for us, as BRRRR investors are those looking to keep properties as rentals, not sell them as flips. To put it simply, if a property will rent for $1,000, and you paid $100,000 for it, it meets the 1% rule. A $200,000 house should rent for $2,000, and a $150,000 house for $1,500. Houses that meet these criteria tend to cash flow stronger than properties that do not. This is most important when considering what area you want to start looking for deals, which deals to look at, and what price you can offer to the seller. If the area has a high percentage of 1% properties, you're more likely to have success there. Please note, a property doesn't have to conform to the 1% rule in order to cash flow positively. There are many factors that go into whether a property will make you money every month. Some properties have HOA, homeowners association, fees, high property taxes, extra insurance required, etc. These are all variables that you wouldn't be able to take into consideration using only the 1% rule. Additionally, I've found the more expensive a property is, the less likely the need to conform to this standard. A $500,000 property would not need to rent for $5,000 a month in order to cash flow positively, whereas a $50,000 property would need to be really close to $500 a month in order to make money. The 1% rule tends to apply more strictly to lower-priced properties, which is where most investors operate. Lastly, keep in mind it's a general rule, not a hard and fast rule. Buying right is something that is non-negotiable. The 1% rule isn't. In times like now, 2018, interest rates are at historical lows. Money is very cheap, and therefore mortgage amounts are abnormally low. This means you can borrow more money and collect less rent than normal but still cash flow well, all because your mortgage expense is exceptionally lower than usual. This gives you more slack when it comes to not meeting the 1% rule but still being able to make money. In general, I've found a property can rent for around 0.08% of the purchase price and usually still be profitable. Because the 1% of the rent is easier to calculate in my head than 0.08, I find myself just using the 1% rule and digging deeper into the properties that get close to it. The purpose of the 1% rule is not to justify a purchase that doesn't make sense. We don't buy every 1% property. Its purpose is to help you decide if looking deeper into a property's financials is a wise use of your time. The 1% rule is a preliminary screening procedure meant to save you time. When I'm choosing a market to invest in, I look for areas that have lots of properties that meet the 1% rule. I know if I can find an area like that, I am much more likely to find success. 75% of ARV. This isn't so much a rule of thumb used by all investors, but it is a metric I use personally when determining what to pay for a property. This rule states that I want my total expenses for a property, acquisition plus rehab, to add up to 75% of what the property will appraise for when I'm finished. It is essentially saying, I'm willing to pay 75 cents on the dollar for what I buy. If you're curious where I came up with the 75% number, it wasn't by coincidence. I've found that most banks are willing to lend at a 75% LTV, loan to value. We will discuss more about LTVs, what they mean, and why they are important in Part 5, the refinance process of this book. For now, understand that if I can hit this metric, I'll be able to recover 100% of the capital I put into a deal once I refinance it. This is always my overall goal. I want my money to be working hard for me, which means I need to get it back after I invest it so I can put it to work again. This is not an easy goal. I have to look long and hard for deals that will meet this standard. That ends up being a good thing, as it forces me to step up my game in the other areas of investing, most notably buying and rehabbing. How properties are valued. Understanding how properties are valued is extremely important in real estate investing. If you understand what impacts a property's value, you can know what to manipulate in order to make your property worth more money. The first thing you should understand is that single-family properties are valued differently than multifamily properties. Single-family properties, anything less than 5 units, are assumed to be bought for the primary purpose of having somewhere to live. Lenders, the force behind deciding how a property will be valued, know the vast majority of buyers for a single-family home are buying it to live there, not as an investment. It's important to remember this because we as investors look at these properties from a different perspective. Since single-family homes are assumed to be bought for the purpose of a dwelling place, they are valued in comparison to other single-family homes. When appraisers are assigned by lenders to give a professional opinion on the value of a single-family home, They compare the property to recently sold properties that are nearby and similar in size and makeup. We call the homes they use to compare the subject property to comparables, or comps for short. If you want to know how your single-family property will be valued, you look at the surrounding homes and find the comps that are closest in size, number of bedrooms, and condition. This is what an appraiser will be looking at when determining the value of the property you purchased. Multifamily properties are different. Multifamily properties are assumed by lenders to be purchased for the purpose of running a business. Lenders know multifamily properties are bought primarily for the purpose of making money, so they are valued as a business. Without me taking too much time to explain, just know that multifamily properties are valued based on the amount of profit they generate, not what other nearby multifamily properties sold for. If you want to increase the value of a multifamily home, you increase its profitability. If you want to increase the value of a single-family home, you improve its condition to compare to other, more valuable single-family homes nearby. Tricks for understanding and increasing a property's value. First off, it's important to recognize that appraisers in different areas use different formulas to determine the values of single-family homes. They are all still comparing them to other single-family homes, but they give weight differently depending on certain aspects of a home. For example, a California-based appraiser is much more likely to give more weight to the proximity and condition of a home than to the square feet of the home. In other areas like the South, appraisers are more likely to use the price per square foot of a home than the condition it's in. Understanding your area and how homes are valued there is a terrific way to make sure you are adding as much value as possible to the properties you buy and rehab. A large chunk of my rental portfolio is in the Southeast. Because of that, I've learned the number of square feet in the properties I buy plays a major role in the overall value of the property when my rehab is finished. If I want to add value to a property that is undersized, adding square feet to the floor plan of the property is the fastest, cheapest, and most efficient way to do that. The reason is because in the Southeast, many appraisers will look at the average price per square foot for other properties in the area. They will take that number, let's call it $100 a square foot, and multiply it by the overall number of square feet in the home, say 1,100. This would give them a number of $110,000. They would then make their adjustments, up or down, based on the condition of my property compared to other nearby properties. If my property was in worse condition, they would adjust down from the $110,000. If my property was in better condition, they would adjust up. Understanding how properties are valued gives me an advantage when looking for how to make my property worth more. The more knowledge I gain, the more tools I have in my tool belt to help me make better decisions. The better decisions I make, the more money I'll end up making too. Throughout this book, I'm going to show you ways to maximize every level of the BRRRR process, increasing the money you make at each step. Finding property deals and analyzing them. As I mentioned before, the most important step in the entire investment cycle is finding a great deal. There is no substitute for it, and if you learned how to do just this one thing well, you'd probably do great with investing. Finding great deals is priority number one if you want to BRRRR successfully. Before you can find a great deal, you need to be able to recognize one. Every investor needs to know what they're looking for, and only then can you know where to find it. I highly recommend writing down your criteria and sharing them with other investors. I know my own criteria very well and share them with everyone I know. My criteria are simple and logical. I look for three things in a deal. 1. To be all in for 75% of ARV. 2. To cash flow positively. 3. To be in an area that won't cause me a headache. Now, these criteria might seem oversimplified, but take a deeper look and you'll see why they work so well for me. 1. If I want to be all in at 75% of ARV, there needs to be a significant amount of equity in a deal before I'll even look at it. This weeds out marginal deals and prevents me from talking myself into a mediocre deal just so I can say I bought something. It protects me from making bad decisions and ensures I have a built-in safety net in case something goes wrong with the rehab or the ARV. 2. If I need my property to cash flow properly, I won't be spending much time looking at anything that isn't in a 1% rule area. This saves me time and energy. 3. If I'm avoiding headache areas, I'll also be avoiding a lot of long-term bad investments. Investing is more fun when you're not constantly frustrated with evictions, destroyed properties, and late rents. I also end up buying in areas that appreciate faster than the surrounding neighborhoods, so I can refinance several times over the period of time I own the property and reinvest the money I pull out. Because I know what I'm looking for, I also end up knowing where to find ideal properties. I spend very little time analyzing the vast majority of properties that other investors waste their time looking into. The more I know what my target looks like, the quicker I realize it when I see it. You should do the same. Knowing what you're looking for in a deal comes first, but you still have to be able to analyze a deal in order to know if it makes sense to buy. In my experience, the number one factor that prevents investors from building wealth is the fear of what could go wrong. The more fear someone has, the less likely they are to take the steps required to move forward. We can't learn if we aren't moving forward. If you want to overcome fear, get good at analyzing deals. As Brandon Turner, the best-selling author of The Book on Rental Property Investing and Bigger Pockets podcast host, says, overcome fear with math. Math won't lie to you. It's not subjective. Math won't confuse you or leave you feeling disillusioned. What Brandon is really saying is this: if you're feeling afraid of the deal, get better at understanding what the deal is with concrete numbers and the fear will disappear. Understanding how to analyze a deal will take so much of the fear and uncertainty out of the decision. When I talk to would-be investors about what holds them back, almost every one of them tells me the same thing: a laundry list of fears or concerns they have about what could go wrong. When I ask these same people what they have done, learned, or studied about how to handle those problems, they almost never have an answer. The solution is simple. Learn to analyze properties, and you'll find yourself feeling much better about the decision to be made regarding whether or not you should buy. The best way to get good at analyzing deals is through practice. Repetition and practice builds mastery. When you first start to analyze properties, there are two things you should focus on. Not coincidentally, they are the same top two things I consider in my own criteria. The first is how much you are buying a property for under its value, how good the deal is. The second is if the property will cash flow positively or not. To know how far below value you are buying a property for, you need to understand a few things. The first is comps. Learn how to find comps and compare them to the property you're evaluating. Other people like agents, appraisers, and wholesalers can help you with this. You can also do some of this research yourself using listing portals like Zillow.com or Realtor.com. The next thing to understand is rehab costs. Learning how to estimate rehab costs is really beneficial. Talking to contractors, handymen, and other investors is a great way to build up your confidence in this area and know if you're overpaying. You want to see the projects from their eyes. If you're using the Burr method, you're very likely to be doing significant rehabs. Learning how to estimate rehab costs is a skill that will come in handy. The last thing to learn is being able to determine whether or not a property will cash flow. My favorite method is what I call the napkin method. You are basically taking the 5 different inputs involved in just about every purchase and quickly calculating them by writing them down on a piece of paper, or a napkin. The five inputs in deals are 1. Rent. 2. Mortgage. 3. Tax. 4. Insurance. 5. Property management fees. We'll talk more later in the book about how to calculate these numbers more accurately. For now, I would recommend creating a baseline in your mind for an average amount of each one. When you look at enough homes in a specific area, you start to get a basic idea of what they cost to own. This basic idea becomes the baseline you will use to help recognize a deal that stands out. For instance, if you're looking at houses between $100,000 and $120,000 in an area, and you look at enough of them, you'll start to recognize patterns in the numbers behind them. Rents may average $1,000 to $1,200. Mortgage amounts may be around $450 to $550. Taxes may be about $100 to $125. Insurance costs may run about $40 to $50. Property management fees at 8% would be about $80 to $96. If you use all conservative numbers in these estimates, you could come up with a baseline to add up either in your head, on a calculator, or on a piece of paper, or a napkin, of course. If you continually do this often enough, you'll start to find patterns in the way the numbers are read. Once you recognize these patterns, a good deal will stand out immediately. That is what you're looking for. The only way to get to this point is by repeatedly analyzing deals over and over. Those who can make the fastest decisions are those who have the most experience. Just like new quarterbacks struggle in the NFL because they don't have much experience reading defenses yet, new investors will struggle because they haven't analyzed enough deals. Commit yourself to analyzing several properties a day, 5 days a week. Do it until you feel you know the result before you even run the numbers. Once you get to that point, you'll find your confidence skyrockets and your fear of the unknown decreases significantly. We want to commit to mastering real estate. You can't claim to be a master of something until you can anticipate what is likely to happen before it does. In this specific circumstance, you want to be able to anticipate which deals will pencil out and which won't before you make the time to analyze them thoroughly. Still don't believe you'll ever be able to do this well? Compare it to other everyday chores you do without even thinking about it. As you walk through the grocery store, you recognize a good deal when one of your staple food purchases is on sale. The reason is simple. When you're used to looking at something over and over, your mind remembers what falls within the pattern of normalcy for that item. When a sale occurs that is outside of the normal pricing, it immediately catches your attention. Real estate isn't any different. Maybe you just haven't been looking at it as much because it feels more intimidating. Rock stars know rock stars. Finding talent to help you find deals. Once you know what you're looking for and how to recognize if it's what you want, the next step is to find people to help you do it. A person alone can only do so much, but by leveraging others whose goals align with yours, you'll find that your success will start to come much, much faster. Rock stars help you accomplish as much as you can in as short amount of time as possible, compared to painstakingly going it alone. Rockstar is a synonym in the world of real estate for someone who is really, really skilled at their job. There are many musicians in the world, but there are very few rock stars. If other people can help you succeed fast, a rock star can help you succeed at ludicrous speed. They are the cream of the crop, masters of their profession, who are equipped with life-changing talent and often have already endured years in the crucible of real estate investing. Having just one rock star in your corner can make you immensely more successful. One of the core principles of your business practice will be to find, attract, and work with as many rock stars as possible. When I look to buy in a new area, my first priority is to find my core four. The core four are the four people I need to invest in any market, anytime. These are the people who will be running my business for me, making me money, and helping me become successful, all while returning the favor. They are my dream team. Even if you're looking to invest where you live, you'll still need a core four. The following are examples of what it looks like to have a rock star at each position. Agent. A rock star real estate agent would be a top producer, the type who knows everybody and is well liked. They are the agents who find deals before anyone else, know how to negotiate the best, and have the brightest minds. They have the most talent on their teams, the best mentors in their corner, and they demand excellence from everyone around them. Rockstar agents have the best referrals because they only work with top lenders, contractors, handymen, and property managers. These agents are never hurting for business, don't lower their commissions, and know real estate like the back of their hand. Rockstar agents got to where they are because they know how to close deals. They've found the right people who can fix problems when they arise, and they have very low tolerance for people who don't. Rockstar agents are usually very resourceful, knowledgeable, and creative. These are all traits you want working for you when it comes to building your wealth. Finding a rockstar agent should be your first priority because they can help you find the rest of your core four. You'll recognize a rockstar agent because they aren't bending over backward to win you over. They are professional, courteous, and helpful, but they have a confidence in their process that won't take a second place to a new investor. Rockstar agents want to educate you on the process, but also get right to the point. If you want to work with an adept agent, you'll need to be comfortable following the process they have in place. It's there because after hundreds of deals, they've learned the best ways to secure them. Lender. A rockstar lender is one who doesn't throw in the towel easily. They have access to the most loan programs, and when a loan doesn't work, they know how to go find one that will. Rockstar lenders know how to help you repair your credit, how to find ways to manipulate data to get you better rates and terms, and can solve problems when they arise. They are tenacious, resilient, and they hustle. Finding a stellar lender can open up financing doors for you that a regular lender cannot. Rockstar lenders became that way because great agents brought them clients. They understand customer service and the need to go the extra mile. A rockstar lender won't say no without proposing an alternative solution. When you find the right lender, ask them about the best agent they know when it comes to finding investment property or other lenders they know that do the kinds of deals you need. If they can't do the kind of deal you need, a great lender will know someone who does. The best way to find a great lender is to ask top-producing real estate agents who they recommend. If the agent you're speaking to works with a lot of investors, they are more likely to know lenders who will do loans for investors. Tell your agent you want to buy properties with them, but you need financing. Ask them who they know. If they don't know anyone, ask them who they can talk to who does. If your agent simply won't make an effort to find you a lender, look for another agent who will. When you do find a rockstar lender, they often have too much business to handle on their own and have hired team members or employees to help them keep up with the demand. For many of those inexperienced in real estate, this can feel uncomfortable or off-putting. Try to remember, it's a good sign if your lender is doing so much business they need help. At the end of the day, this is a business transaction. And if you don't always speak to the main lender on every phone call, that's okay, as long as the transaction closes. Contractor. Rockstar contractors may not look like what you think at first. They may not answer your calls right away or be the best communicators. That's not what makes a great contractor, at least not for an investor. An ideal contractor for an investor is someone who understands what needs to be done, how to do it, and how to save you money on it. They are a contractor who understands your business goals, not just their own. They are people who can tell you what the best plan of action for your property is before you even look at it. Rockstar contractors get the job done inexpensively and correctly. These are the people who know when they can save you money with tile they found on sale, or can make repairs to existing structural components when an average contractor would make you go buy new materials. These contractors are always looking for ways to make themselves money by saving you money. They understand your needs. Great contractors can communicate with the city for you to get permits approved and can provide you with recommendations that other contractors wouldn't think of. Great contractors know the best roofers, HVAC services, plumbers, electricians, and more. They are concerned about your bottom line, but they are also concerned about their own. Knowing a rockstar contractor can open up doors for you to buy deals that you couldn't even consider without them. Property manager. A first-rate property manager is someone who knows the areas you're investing in. They manage many rental properties in the area you're investing, and they have a large sample size of properties they've learned from. These people know which areas work and which do not, and they will share that information with you if you let them. Rockstar property managers likely own properties themselves, and that's why they got into property management. They have access to the best handymen or repair crews because they have been looking for them for their own properties. They can be an excellent source of referrals for you. And they can also oftentimes be an underutilized deal source. These property managers know other investors who want to sell before anyone else does. They are the ones managing those properties. Top-rate PMs tend to want to take care of your problems without getting you involved, and are better at handling them than you would be yourself. They are more experienced than you, more connected than you, and more knowledgeable than you. When you find the right project manager, they will teach you more about investing than you could hope to learn, and they make you better just from being around them. You know you have found a rockstar property manager when your first inclination is to call them when a new deal comes your way. Rockstars play with rockstars. When you're a rockstar, and you know you're an actual rockstar, you don't waste your time playing with mediocre bandmates. The best will always surround themselves with top talent and demand everyone put in equivalent effort. They search for the best drummers, the best vocalists, best guitar players, everything. In my experience, top-level talent only works with loyal and honest clients. If you aren't someone who's serious, they are going to figure that out pretty quickly. If you aren't someone who's honest or fair, they'll know that too. If that happens, you'll likely find yourself kicked out of the concert and listening from the parking lot while everyone else rocks out. In the world of real estate investing, that can end up costing you a lot of money. Don't let that happen. If we already know rock stars play with rock stars, start working on becoming one yourself. Everyone asks me, how do I get the best to work with me? The answer is simple. Become someone worthy of working with them. Agents are in this business for the same reason you are, to make money. So are lenders, contractors, property managers, and everyone else. Too many investors think it's okay for them to make money, but expect everyone else to serve their needs for free. This kind of thinking will never get you anywhere but frustrated. Top talent expects to be paid for their work, and they aren't shy to admit that. If you are too worried about what someone else is making, you're not focused enough on the role you're supposed to be playing in your business. If you want the best to work with you, start acting like you're also the best. Learn to give value first. Learn to find what these rock stars need in their business or their life and bring that to them. Take the attitude of the servant first, putting your fears behind you and instead focusing on proving to them why it's in their best interest to help you. I know this sounds counterintuitive, but it's the best thing I've done to help grow my own business. Now, if you are reading this section and think it's bad advice, my guess is you probably trusted the wrong person in the past and got burned for it. Don't make the mistake of trying to prove yourself to mediocre or below average talent. That is the fastest way to get taken advantage of. Practical advice for proving your value to top talent. If you're looking for some easy ideas for how to bring value to the core four you want to surround yourself with, here are a few that worked for me. What I've found is before I could learn what others need, I had to first learn how their job worked. Once I figured that out, it became apparent how I could help each person. Trying to bring value to someone before you recognize their business model is an exercise in futility. But taking some time to walk in someone else's shoes will help you find the best way to assist them. Agents. Agents live by referrals. If you can send an agent business, you will be making them money, and that is going to lead them to be very loyal to you and make them very happy. An easy way to send referrals is by talking to your friends about real estate and sending the serious buyers to the agents. Start an online blog, meetup, discussion group, or chat room and send interested buyers to the agents you want to make a good impression on. This will help people remember to send you deals as well as score you points with the agents. Remember to only send serious buyers to the agents. Sending them referrals who have no intention to buy but instead only want a free education is a great way to prove you bring work without pay, not the reputation you want. Communicate openly with your agent. Tell them exactly what you'd like them to do and share your thoughts. Agents want to help you, but they can only do so if you know what kind of help you want. Take it from me, an agent. This one is big. Give them great reviews online. Giving your agent a great review on Facebook, Zillow, Yelp, or Google can earn you some major brownie points. Call your agent's boss and tell them how great they are. Find out who supervises them and give them a great review. Ask them what they need in their business and help them find it. If they work with a lot of investors, they may very well need a solid handyman to fix dry rot or a great roofer who doesn't overcharge. If you can give them a referral they need, you're likely to get to the top of their list when the next great deal comes along. Give them bonuses. Yes, I know to an investor this idea seems painful, but think about it. I often buy houses for $40,000 that are completely trashed. How much is my agent making on this? Giving them a bonus to at least help them make a decent amount of money is a great way to stay in their good graces. Lenders. Lenders also want referrals. Send your friends their way. Online reviews. This works for lenders too. Let their boss know you appreciate their hard work. Introduce lenders to websites like BiggerPockets.com. Many lenders don't realize there are entire communities of people out there who are looking for investment properties and need a lender. Check in with them once you've introduced them to BiggerPockets and see if they've gotten any clients. It never hurts to remind someone what you've done for them. Give them great references to rockstar agents. This is how lenders get their deals. If you do this, they'll love you for it. Give them a shout out on social media. Let everyone know how great they are by tagging them in a nice post and make sure they see it too. Contractors. Pay them on time. Seriously, just do it. You have no idea how much this means to a contractor. Pay them in a way that isn't a pain in the butt for them. I've found wire transfer to be the easiest. Don't ask them to work for free. If you want additional work done, ask them how much more it will be and make your decision accordingly. Don't micromanage. Nobody likes that. Don't beat them up over little things like $10 off the paint quote. They'll remember, and they'll return the favor. Ask them questions. Some contractors are willing to do certain jobs, but don't enjoy it. Things like laying tile as opposed to laminate. If it doesn't matter to you, have them do the laminate instead so they know you have their back. Ask them what work they are doing and what they are contracting out. They can give you better prices on the work they do themselves. It puts them in a bad position when you want them to reduce the price significantly for work they are subcontracting to someone else. They don't feel comfortable negotiating someone else's money. Don't ask them to bid jobs if you're not serious, and if you do, pay them for their time. Sending someone to bid a job when you weren't likely to buy the property and not paying them is a great way to let them know you are not a rock star. Send them referrals when practical. Send them leads for people they can hire. Contractors are always looking for new employees and often frustrated with it. If you know of a hard worker who is dependable, let them know. Property managers. Send them referrals. Are you noticing a pattern here? Ask them what investors do that makes their job harder and try to stop doing it. Read the actual management agreement and address the issues you see before signing a contract with them. Don't be that person who throws a fit when you're charged for something you didn't bother to look at first, then blame them for it. Don't call them incessantly over unimportant things. Property management is a low-pay, time-consuming job. They have to be very careful with their time. Show them you respect that. Ask them about properties before you buy them. Get them involved in the process and rely on their expertise early on. If the house doesn't rent for what you thought it would, don't automatically blame them. They can't control the market. Reply to them in a timely fashion, like you'd want them to reply to you. Find other investors and introduce them to the property managers. They are always looking to grow their network. Find out if they are licensed, and if they are, let them find you deals. This is good supplemental income for a lot of them. Tell them what you need, so they can be on the lookout for you. Communication here is also essential. Finding ways to bring value to others is one of the most important business skills you can learn. Considering that one good property can bring you hundreds of dollars in monthly cash flow and tens of thousands of dollars in equity, it becomes apparent just how much money you can lose by not treating people well. In business, there is a popular maxim: your network equals your net worth. Relationships bring and build business. Understanding the rockstars know rockstars concept is the first step in finding good talent to help you accomplish your goals. If you want to work with the best, you need to be the best. Finding a rockstar is better than finding a deal because they can bring you many deals. The search for talent should be number one on your list when looking for great deals in the acquisition stage of your investment cycle. Using wholesalers to find deals. Wholesalers weren't mentioned as part of the core four because they typically don't provide as much value as an agent. They do, however, play a very similar role. A wholesaler is